The OTB Brief. Everything you need to know about sport every morning. Need to get on top of the day's sports news? Well, the OTB Brief is the only sports update you'll need every morning. With all the breaking stories, post-match reaction.
I always look about, you know, teams who've won a league, their mindsets, their body language, their hunger, desire. And I see that so much in this Liverpool team.
And the best bits from off the ball, all in a 10-minute podcast.
Rory McIlroy's game has changed a lot.
The OTB Brief. Weekday mornings from 7:20 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. Listen on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now then, you're welcome along. We're chatting through the Sunday Papers. I will start you off with the headlines. The hurling leads the way in many cases, as you can imagine. Back page here of the Mail on Sunday, and it's a picture of Darragh Lyons of Waterford at the full-time whistle, hands on his hips, just breathing that in, and I'm sure it feels very good. Dazzling Dacia, too hot for cats. Wonderful Waterford fight back, sees off Kilkenny in hurling semi-final classic at Croker. Final score, Waterford 227, Kilkenny 223. They were 9 points down at one stage, and at half-time, the game really felt over if you didn't see it. Sunday Times then, they're going with the hurling as well. Oh, what a night is the headline. Waterford into hurling final after stunning comeback against Kilkenny. And then over here on the right-hand side, it's about Jurgen Klopp. Klopp mounts a new attack on TV scheduling. This was Jurgen Klopp yesterday after the 1-1 draw with Brighton. He was talking to Des Kelly of BT Sports. The tone was set early when Kelly asked if Milner had injured a hamstring, and Klopp said, yeah, congratulations, as in, it's your fault. And there was a back and forth. It was pretty good TV. Kelly was making the point that Klopp really should be talking to Liverpool's chief executive and those of other clubs. You know, if you come down here, he said to Klopp, and just have a go at broadcasters, it's not going to change anything. And then also Klopp had a go at Chris Wilder. Chris Wilder has called Klopp selfish on the point of the five substitutions rule. He says, when we had a talk with managers a week ago, it was 55, if not 60% in favour of five subs. Since then, nothing happened. Chris Wilder, or whoever, says I'm selfish. I think all the things that shows he is selfish. That's what Klopp said. Sunday Independent, again, it's Waterford here. Comeback Kings, Waterford rally from 9 points down to stun Cats and book final place. And then on the right-hand side, Klopp takes aim at reporter and Wilder as injuries mount. Where are we next? Sunday Mirror. It's Waterford and Klopp again. So Klopp, gross injustice on the top, and then watch shots, as in Waterford. On Fire Dacia set their sights in All-Ireland final after blasting back to shoot down the Cats, 227 to 223. Sun Sport then, they're going with, again, the same thing really, Klopp and hurling. So it's Glory Dacia on the top here. Bennett hits net. That was Shane Bennett, who scored a brilliant goal last night to really kickstart the Waterford comeback just after halftime. And then Jurgen Strop. Klopp says BT Sport to blame for Milner injury. Boss rage at dangerous fixtures and Chris Wilder too. And then Sunday World, we have Water Joys. Kilkenny 223, Waterford 227. Bennett and De Burka have Dacia in Winter Wonderland. Picture of those two hugging it out after the full-time whistle. And Kloppy is starting to get stroppy. Red Chiefs has lots of grievances, says Kevin Palmer. And I should mention this as well. This is the main section of the Sunday Times, and it's Justine McCarthy on the front page. New Gibney abuse investigation. Justine McCarthy here writing that Gardaí are investigating new complaints of child sexual abuse against George Gibney after being contacted by victims who listened to a podcast series about the former Olympic swimming coach. This is the Where Is George Gibney podcast series with second captains and BBC Sounds, Mark Corrigan and Kieran Cassidy behind it. Gibney, as I'm sure you all know, Ireland's national coach, then national coach, escaped prosecution in 1994 on 27 charges of raping and sexually assaulting young swimmers because the Supreme Court found he couldn't adequately defend himself because some of the charges dated back as far as 1967. And he's been living in the States for the last 25 years. Part of the podcast, if you haven't heard it, is tracking him down and seeing what he's up to now and trying to speak to him, as they did in a car park, but they got nothing back. In this piece by Justine McCarthy, the Garda Press Office would not comment on the new cases. They say, on Garda Síochána is continuing an ongoing active criminal investigation. We are not providing any further comment at this time. So that's on the front page of the main section, Sunday Times Today. We have with us to review the paper Shane Keegan of the Dundalk coaching staff and Brendan O'Brien from the Irish Examiner. Gents, you're both very welcome. Shane, the hurling's everywhere on the front pages, as you might imagine.
Yeah, absolutely everywhere, Joe, and rightly so. I mean, what another absolutely fantastic All-Ireland semi-final. We don't seem to get anything but fantastic All-Ireland semi-finals in the hurling. And yeah, look, there's some good pieces. Dennis Walsh, Michael Foley, Dermot Crowe, all very, very good pieces. But I suppose they're essentially all making three or four of the same points, which are probably all worth discussion. Obviously, very, very much a tale of two halves. I mean, at halftime, it looked like it was going to be 2008 all over again, potentially, that they could be blown out of the water that much. But as Michael Foley makes the point, it was a third quarter where Waterford finished 212 to 5 points in 5 minutes. Or sorry, it's 212 to 5 points in 22 minutes that essentially swung the whole game around. But I'll tell you, I don't know about yourselves, but the one thing you'd have to say about Waterford is that they're absolutely box office. They really are box office. Whereas Kilkenny were much more about kind of efficiency, even when they were going well in the first half, was much more about efficiency. And then the one star name, I suppose, in TJ being absolutely sublime again yesterday. With Waterford, I mean, where do you start with some of the players they have? I mean, is there a more frustrating hurler in Ireland to watch than Austin Gleeson? Because, I mean, what he showed yesterday absolutely went from the sublime to the ridiculous, or more so ridiculous to the sublime, really. But himself, I thought Callum Lyons had moments where he was sensational, moments where he made awful mistakes. Mm. Tyke de Burke came in and out of it. It was a really, really crazy, crazy game. So it was. But yeah, Austin Gleeson for me is certainly the main talking point from.
Well, Dennis Walsh says Waterford needed their big players to deliver. Austin Gleeson had been fumbling for any trace of form, and for 35 minutes last night, he was mostly a passive figure. In the second half, though, he was more productive and engaged than he's been in ages. And he says at a different point, Dennis, ultimately the game turned on elemental stuff. Waterford asserted control in the air, Kilkenny repeatedly beaten under their own puckouts. When the ball went to ground, Waterford dominated the rooks too, and time again, Kilkenny players were met with a swarm of tackles and body hits. And he talks about the comeback being ignited by a mesmerising solo goal from Stephen Bennett 2 minutes into the second half. Sorry, I called him Shane earlier on. Stephen Bennett, we had him on the show this week, I should know. So, I mean, watching the game last night, Brendan, Kilkenny settled straight away. TJ Reid started picking off scores and Waterford looked really up for it, but they were jittery and making some terrible mistakes. And you just thought, well, this game has gone away from them terribly. They were 8 down at halftime. They'd had 9 wides, a lot of bad wides as well. It's really hard to explain what happened in that second half, but it was totally gripping to watch it.
It was fantastic. And Shane touched on the 2008 final when Kilkenny absolutely destroyed Waterford, a day that nobody will ever forget who saw it. And Mick Foley's piece today is quite interesting as well. It's interesting that we're kind of 9 months into this COVID-19 environment in terms of sport, and yet we can still kind of deduce certain angles out of it, out of the fact that there's no fans at the stadium. And Mick's point is that Waterford's victory is even greater for the fact that they managed it without the fuel of a full Croke Park. This was a game, again, that was entirely stripped of all the normal context. And it's interesting, you can take two points of view as to how that helped. And Liam Cahill, the Waterford manager, was speaking afterwards, talking about, well, actually, maybe the lack of a crowd in the first half helped Waterford, that there wasn't any of these groans or a crowd kind of losing its belief in the team as they were so bad in the first half. I mean, you talk about Kilkenny in the first half, Joe. Kilkenny were okay. They weren't fantastic. I mean, the whole story of that first half was just quite simply how bad Waterford were. And as Shane is right, I mean, you had visions of this could get very, very nasty very quickly. So that absence of a crowd, did it play into Waterford? Possibly did a little bit. But for any team to be able to turn it around in the manner they did, I mean, that cliche of a game of two halves is there for a reason. But for Waterford to kind of just find that within themselves, whatever was said at half time, whatever was done tactically, maybe that we can't see under the surface, it was an extraordinary thing to do. And then you layer on top of that the historical baggage that's there between these two counties. I mean, that's the first time in their history they've beaten Kilkenny twice in succession in the championship, all the beatings they've taken, the border. I mean, that's an extraordinary win when you put all that context behind it.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, second semi-final today. Brendan, your screen is frozen, so we're just going to dial you back and get you set up properly in just 1 second.
No worries.
On the George Gibney front page, people might be curious to hear more, Shane. If you go to page 21 inside then, there's a more in-depth piece by Justin McCarthy. I don't know if you've listened to the podcast, Shane.
I have, Joe. Okay. I have, absolutely. First and foremost, I thought it was an absolutely fantastic podcast, everything about it. Obviously, it's getting the height of praise and rightfully so. And to me, this is, I suppose, no surprise. As you were listening to the podcast, I was thinking to myself as it was going along, this is definitely going to lead to more victims stepping forward. I really, really did believe that was going to be the case as I was listening to it. And I also thought that because of the compassion he shows the whole way through the making of it, I also thought that it would be directly to Mark Horgan that they'd probably raise their issues with. So it really doesn't surprise me. And how could anybody directly involved with that, how could it not stir emotions in them and make them come forward? I mean, I was driving along listening to it one day. Joe was on the way across to work, and it was the episode where they talked about the fact that he had been working in the swimming pool in Marion College. And honest to God, it caused me to swerve the car. Marion College was my secondary school. It was the swimming pool that we regularly went to, obviously, with it being the secondary school swimming pool. And I had no idea of that. And it even, you know, that struck a small chord with me. I mean, that's me very much been on the periphery of things. For anybody who was in any way directly involved in all of this, it was inevitable to me that more people were going to step forward, you know?
Yes. So Justine writes inside that it has led to abuse complaints being made to Gardaí by two former swimmers. So two former swimmers have gone directly to the Gardaí. This development and the question of what lies next for Gibney will be addressed in the final two episodes released on Thursday and next week. Is it possible that the Dubliner, now in his 70s, could be extradited back home to face trial, she writes, more than a quarter of a century after the Supreme Court ruled against his prosecution? There's a quote from Mark Horgan. We've had people contact us who were sexually assaulted and abused over long periods of time, and other people who just had one incident. Some have gone on the record and they will feature in the final episodes. He says it later on, you don't want to raise hopes if they're going to be dashed again, but this is a man who has spent no time in jail. Later on, Mark says, people who've contacted us are horrified he's still in a position in society where he's purporting to be a good person who can take care of the vulnerable. This is over in the States. I approached him in Florida. We sent numerous right to reply invitations, but he's never responded in any way. He's done what he's done since 1994. He's keeping his mouth shut. And an interesting point made by Mark at the end, and a very sad one as well. One of the remarkable things is that most of those who have contacted us are women. To me, that shows that stigma still exists for male survivors of sex abuse. As we know, Gibney abused males too. I hope men realise the country is a kinder place now and that they will be believed. There are so many awful aspects to this, Shane. You read that quote, and one of those aspects is to think of the people who were abused and who haven't been able to find the strength, and I can only imagine the strength it takes to ever tell anyone of it.
Yeah, incredibly so. And while Mark makes that point, at the same time, I'm sure he also understands that it is the right and prerogative of those maybe not to come forward if you know, if they feel that would be too harrowing an experience. Yeah. Well, then you can completely understand where they're coming from too.
You can, absolutely. Well, that's George Gibney, page one of the Sunday Times main section, page 21 inside in the main section. Brendan, Diego Maradona, story of the week in many respects. Where do you want to go? Yeah. It's everywhere.
It is everywhere. And it was curious this morning to kind of pick up the papers and think, well, where does it go from here? I mean, he passed away midweek, and we saw plenty of stuff on radio, on TV, online, in the papers. And I suppose the aspect of it that I've really enjoyed digesting over the last few days is the people who knew him, or the people who at least played alongside him or beside him. Jorge Valdano did a fantastic article that was translated into English in The Guardian by Sid Lowe during the week. And it's just those little, you're reading a lot of it and a lot of it you're familiar with, and then you see a nugget here and there, and that's lovely, that's great, that's fantastic. And it just it paints a bit of a different picture of it. And the one that I really enjoyed this morning was Ozzy Ardiles has a piece in the Daily Mail, in the Irish Daily Mail. And I'd forgotten really how, or I didn't know really how close Ardiles was to him. I mean, Ardiles obviously was a key member of the Argentina team in 78 that won the World Cup, but he goes into a lot of detail about Maradona coming in onto the scene at that time. And the only kind of broad brushstroke that I knew about that was that Maradona was in with a shout of making the squad. And you'd read a throwaway line, he was devastated about not making it. Obviously, a World Cup in his home country. He was a young guy. He was only a teenager at the time. But Ardiles kind of fills out that picture of why he didn't make it. And the manager, Cesar Menotti, was had made a promise to the team, to the squad that he had built up over the previous months and years, that he would use them come the World Cup. And Maradona didn't make it. But the really fascinating thing about it is that Ardiles says at one time that the one problem they had as a team during that tournament was that they didn't really have a number 10. And he says here that they started with Jose Daniel Valencia, Norberto Alonso, then did Ricky Villa, who ended up at Tottenham Hotspur, and they finished with Mario Kempes, who everybody will remember scoring the goals, a centre forward who played at number 10. And the line Ardiles comes up with is, what might we have been like with Diego? You know, a world champion team that people would say on balance was a much more talented team all around than the one that Maradona took to Mexico in 86. So that kind of thing, I mean, that kind of insight into Maradona the player. And Ardiles as well, later in the piece, does a lot about Maradona the person. You know, everything he had to put up with. And we've seen before, Liam Brady in his column in the Examiner during the week spoke about one thing he always noticed when he played against him in Italy was, if Maradona slalomed past six players and set a chance up on a plate for a teammate and the teammate missed it, was never a kind of an eyes up to heaven or slapping his hips in exasperation. He was such a team player. And Ardiles talks about that as well, how humble he was as well. He never joined in the laughter or the mockery. He was incredibly sharp at the banter. There was no point getting into a verbal contest with him. So it's that kind of stuff that paints the fuller picture of him. I think we've all watched the two goals against England a million times as well. And just even in terms of the video footage we've seen, one of the fascinating ones that I saw was a clip of his time with Barcelona in La Liga and the punishment he took. I mean, it's those lesser known facts about him that have kind of come to the fore in the last 3 or 4 days that have really given us a better picture of him as a player and as a person.
Yes, Ardiles met him, ironically, the first time I met him was when Ardiles was in the national side and they used to bring out talented youngsters to juggle the ball in front of the crowd to keep them entertained. And that was when he first came across Maradona as a young teenager. And he said that he was so extraordinary that we came out to watch him at times. The national team players went out to watch him perform and said, how can he even do this? That was how I met my lifelong friend. Within a year we'd meet again, he was training with the national side. And he talked about the warm-ups even. It's a lovely, you know, he'd blast the ball up in the air and then when the ball was in the air, he'd be asking you how things were and then trap the ball perfectly as it came down. And we've all seen his warm-ups. They're kind of magical and rhythmic and just so expressive. He said most of the time the opponents stopped their warm-up to watch, knowing that 10 minutes later they would be playing against this monster. And he talks about, in Argentinian football, we have this myth about El Pipe, or the boy. It is the little skillful boy footballer who succeeded against all the odds and makes it big. That is the legend behind El Pipe. It's part of our culture, and Diego fulfilled that role absolutely. And as you said, Brendan, he talks about Maradona's character and says, at the 1990 World Cup finale when Argentina lost in the final, Diego was in incredibly bad shape, he says, physically. And to play every game, he had cortisone injections. In 94, it was the same. He was taking drugs to get him through games. So drugs were always there. There was no control in his life at that stage. He would always say to me, if I was a good boy and looked after myself, imagine the player I could be. So that's Ardiles in the Mail on Sunday. I mean, there's loads of other interesting bits, Shane. There's in the main section of the Sunday Independent, Paddy Agnew, who was in Italy when Maradona was there, remembers the day they won the championship and getting the train down to Naples and just the outpouring, which was just so extraordinary. And equally, the Sunday Independent went a different route. They published Eamon Dunphy from 1991, in April 1991. This was when Maradona was banned for cocaine. for 15 months. Yeah. And Dunphy wrote about that situation at the time in 1991. So today, the Sunday Independent have republished that article. I mean, it reads as if Maradona has died in 1991, which may be an effect from a plain point of view he had. So it's it kind of works today.
It does. And in fairness, both pieces have their similarities, Joe, in that obviously there's this, you know, massively, massively complex character, and you're trying to weigh up, okay, the guy on the pitch against the guy off the pitch, and how do you get the balance in terms of all the brilliant things, you know, how do you set your mind at ease with adoring this guy when so many other things were so wrong or going so badly in his life. I mean, the Paddy Agnew one is brilliantly written, because Paddy Agnew's obviously in the advantageous situation where he's on the ground in Italy at a time where Maradona is the lord of football. And it's really, really interesting to hear him go. He heads off, as you say, to that game in 87. And to be, I know the first bit that I thought was funny was where he meets him after goes into the press conference after the game that he's attended. You know, when Maradona eventually walks into the room, I think he takes his time in getting there, but when he eventually walks into the room, the assembled media make a dash towards him, but it's not a dash towards him looking for quotes. It's a dash towards him basically to touch him, to be around him, to heap praise on him, which is obviously not really the way journalists are supposed to conduct themselves, but he takes it as a kind of a sign that it was their way of saying, look, you know, we're willing to ignore it all. We're willing to ignore everything else that's going on, because you just keep producing on the pitch and you stay doing that and you keep giving us headlines on the pitch and we won't make you the headline off the pitch. And in the long run, obviously, that's probably turned out to be a very, very bad thing. Like, Paddy makes the point that really where he found himself at Napoli was the best place in the world for him to be at that point in his career, because he could relate so much to the people from there in terms of poverty and been looked down upon and given all something to believe in. But then because of I suppose, the whole mafia situation, I mean, he talks about the night he won the league. Maradona spent that night in one of the mafia godfather's houses. That's where the major celebration was. Mm. So, I mean, how could this man not end up in all sorts of murky situations? And, you know, the drug situation, he also makes the point, how did Maradona go as far as 1991 without testing positive for drugs?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is a good question. He finishes up, well, I know in one instance there is, there was a fake plastic penis used for a urine sample, which is now in a museum somewhere. So who knows what kind of chicanery went on half the time. Interestingly, Paddy Agnew does make the point. As for the player, people always wonder just how good he could have been
if
he had led a model, healthy, professional life. Simply, he would have been consistently at Mexico 86 level. He had prepared intensively for that tournament with a two-month training period, no drugs, no alcohol, and he arrived in Mexico fitter than ever in his life. That was the real Maradona. As someone privileged to have seen him play often, I can only thank the sporting gods for Maradona. Thank God for football and these tears. And that is a scary thought, isn't it? That, you know, 2 months off the booze and off the cocaine, and that's what we saw at 86.
It is. I don't know if I fully agree with you, though, Joe. You know, you get the conversations about Maradona, and you know, you get it quite similarly about Best as well, and even around Brazilian Ronaldo in terms of how much of a role injuries played. This will probably go against most people, but I will tend to remove the romanticized version of it and give me the fella who has done it rather than the fella who could have done it, if that makes sense. And that's, look, that is absolutely not to doubt the brilliance of Maradona or his legacy at all, but could he have played to that level for 10 or 15 years? Messi has played to that level for 10 or 15 years. I don't know if Maradona could have produced that level for that longevity, you know?
Why not, though? If he was born at a different time, if he was born in the Messi era and was better looked after and had better people around him, there's every chance he could have, no?
Yeah. And that's the comeback is very, very much easy. You know, was he a product of his time? But was he a product of his time, or is he a product of, without trying to sound disparaging, but his upbringing? You know, he did come from a very, very particular background where he was maybe, regardless of what era he was born in, was he always going to struggle with having masses amounts of fame and money an adoration thrown at him. What regard, if he was, you know, if he was playing now, would he have been able to handle all of that situation any better than back then? Maybe not. Maybe not.
We'll never know, I guess. It's the interesting question. It's the what could have been, as you said. Brennan, you might give us a sense of what Eamon Dunphy was saying back in April 1991.
Yeah, I was kind of struck by this piece. Parts of it annoyed me, I have to say, because there was a tendency to kind of whitewash the past in what Dunphy was saying. There was parts of it talking about, could you blame Maradona for the hand of God? And he says, the answer is no, you couldn't, because he knew what football was like, a moral cesspit riddled with cynicism, cheating of all kinds, policed by smug administrators who were themselves the subject of suspicion and the charge of financial corruption. And it's brilliantly written, as everything with Dunphy, and it draws you in. But is that really everything that was going through his mind as he stuck his hand up above Peter Shilton in 86? I doubt it. And Dunphy goes on a lot in this piece. It's awash with nostalgia. At one point, he's talking about soccer as a game largely without honour in the modern world of cheating. And he goes back to the days of Bobby Charlton and Pele. And I always remember that same era, George Best, when he was playing for Manchester United, used to tell the story about when they played the continental teams in the European Cup, some of the defenders had this trick where they would absolutely clatter into the ground and they would make a play of picking him up with one hand and with the other they'd pinch him in his armpit or something. And Best would lash out and get a booking for it and look like the bad guy. Football was riddled with corruption and dirty defenders long before Maradona came along. So it's kind of nearly an apology for the dark side of him as a footballer. And he talks about Bobby Moore and Pele exchanging shirts in Mexico in 1970 as the kind of the, you know, if you could have a piece up on your wall alongside a picture of JFK and our Lord, it would be, you know, in a football context, it would be Bobby Moore and Pele. Look at this. I mean, nothing was ever wrong with football in 1970. And we know that wasn't the case. So I find it very interesting that's the context he's trying to paint it. But as ever with Dunphy, it's an article that does get you thinking.
Yeah, for sure. Maradona, he said in 91, he belongs on the list among men whose legacy to the sport cannot be measured in trophies won or money earned, which is a great line. Like the great composers, the Unforgettables created new music. They did it their way. He says later on, his game was based on danger. Daringly, he drew defenders into the desperate tackle, which he eluded by inches before luring the next victim into his trap. His balance was unearthly, as were his vision, pace and power. The touch heavenly, the final thrust as sure as any radar-guided missile. Used about any other footballer of this age, those words would be mere hyperbole. In Maradona's case, they are simply truth. It says at one point, cocaine is a fashionable drug used by wealthy, bored people with too much time on their hands and too little nourishment in their souls, which is a hell of a line. And he just does with the burden on Maradona as well. You couldn't blame him, alas, you couldn't adore him either. His career has been a poignant, salutary parable of football's long, agonizing descent into the grave. Genius was brutalized. The great player, the first victim of cynicism, his body becoming a chemical sewer full of cortisone and other painkilling drugs. Then the victor, his hand of God, doing to the spirit of football what the pills he consumed were doing to his body, killing. I mean, it's great stuff as well.
It's probably worth putting the time into context as well, Joe. Yeah. You know, it's 1991 with the worst World Cup in living memory.
Yeah.
In Italia 90, the back pass was only just being outlawed. You know, the state of the game in the UK, which obviously would have, you know, subconsciously fed into this article as well. Football was dour. Stadiums were dour, there was violence everywhere. So in that sense, it's very much an article of its time and it feeds into that. And then at the very end of it, even more so, he says, one wonders what will become of him now and where the next great footballer will come from and what the game will do to him if he ever comes. So it's very much in that and of its era at the time. And I mean, we can look at that now and say, well, look, we've two of the greatest players ever for the last 15 years. And as you pointed out earlier, you know, and Shane, would Maradona, what would he have done now had he more understanding, had he more of a structure outside him? So it is what it is, and it is of its time.
Yes, no, that's a very good point. The game is at a low ebb here in comparison to what would happen over the following two, three decades. You know, it was at a low ebb. On the hand of God thing, and I'm not talking about the Dunphy piece here or any piece in particular, don't we all just read way too much into it? Like, what did it mean? What does it say about the game? What does it say about Maradona? It was an instinctive reaction to a moment. He ran off and celebrated. The ref gave it, and he thought, okay, great. I mean, that's all it was. It wasn't wasn't a pre-planned meditation on cheating.
But that's the thing, like, that I said at the start about the Dunphy thing. You know, could you blame him for the goal? And then he goes into everything about, you know, smug administrators who are themselves the subject of suspicion on the charge of financial corruption. Yeah. I agree entirely with your point. It's an instinctive reaction, and it goes back to that cultural thing in South America and Southern Europe, where to get one over there's a phrase on it which I can never remember, which the likes of Sid Lowe and these guys will talk about, but it's in the culture, whereas they see it as, yay, it's the little man getting one over on the system. Mm. Whereas, you know, in the Anglo world, it's just, that's cheating. It's not playing cricket, you know? Yeah. So that's just the thing. I mean, he saw an angle and he went for it.
Yes. Eamon Sweeney says, magic realist will outlive any moral tales. This is his take on Maradona's legacy. Who's the greatest? Who can say for sure? But no one's dominated a World Cup the way Maradona did in 86. He was the great. He gave the greatest performance in the world's greatest tournament. Draw your own conclusions. And makes the point again about Napoli, which you can't overstate for people who aren't fully aware of how poor Napoli were. No one in the history of club football has done what Maradona did with Napoli. I mean, it would be a hell of a test case if Lionel Messi was forcibly dropped into a team of Napoli's stature and we could see what happened. He said that Napoli avoided relegation by a single point the year before he had arrived, and they'd never won the Serie A title. The next five seasons, they won two titles, runners-up twice, and win the UEFA Cup. And all this in a league which was not just the best in the world at the time, but as strong as any league had ever been, which really puts it into context. There's lots of different approaches. Like David Kelly, beneath that, it's just open in front of me, but he writes a really personal piece. It's less getting into the nuts and bolts of Maradona. It's more what Maradona meant to him. And that definitely has a place in the papers today. You know, 1980s were bleak. Free Republic, where to be gay earned you a vicious kicking, or to be unexpectedly pregnant sent you into a cold graveyard or onto a colder ferry, where being unwanted invited abuse and neglect, a land of saints and scholars ran by corrupt politicians. Grey was the preeminent shade, brown was positively vivacious, and he splashes a colour treated with suspicion. And so he says, a World Cup drowned us in drunken sangria sun. By the age of 13, music and football were escape valves from the dreariness, and the Mexico World Cup was a captivating reservoir for the frustrated yearnings of a child from a broken home. And he goes on to talk about, you know, what Maradona did to a 13-year-old back then. I'm too young to remember 86. Annie?
Well, I was just going to make that point, Joe, is that I don't know about the two of you, but I think we're all of a reasonably similar-ish age bracket. And the one thing about all reading all of the pieces and looking at some of the programs that have been shown on TV again, or some of the social media footage, it does make you incredibly jealous of those that got to see him in the flesh, and you know, it really grates me that I didn't get to see a talent, and it's kind of almost focused my own mind that I've got a 5-year-old at home, and it's kind of almost focused my own mind that, right, as soon as this pandemic clears, you've got to do whatever you've got to do to make sure he gets this Messi play before Messi finishes up. You know, like if I was Connor and in 20 years' time he found out he was around when Messi wasn't playing and I hadn't gotten to see him in the flesh, I'd kill me. So it would. But yeah, he is a guy I would have absolutely loved to have seen in the flesh, you know?
You're doing me a great service there, Shane. I'm a couple of years older than the two of you guys, so I do remember 86. I would have been 10 at the time. And my memory of that, and again, it's probably an example of the impact that Maradona had. Myself and my brothers and a lot of people, and it's of course that time we didn't get to see these guys until every 4 years, but we were all Brazil fans really at the time. You know, you go back to 78, they were robbed of an appearance in the final. 82, the greatest Brazil team never to have won a World Cup, and by 86 I think the neutral was still a Brazil fan, and it was the Brazilian jerseys that really lit the fire underneath you. And to be honest, my strongest memory of Mexico 86 is still Brazil-France in the quarterfinal, which was a superb game. But Maradona came out of that, and by the end of the tournament, it was Maradona. I remember in my local shop in Port Leash, Shane, in the Midlands, the jerseys they got in were Argentina jerseys that winter. They were the ones that sold. Nobody was looking for Brazil top. I mean, this guy changed our perception of South American football in the space of 4 weeks. That's exactly what he did. So all this, and our parents as well, my dad would have been a huge fan of obviously Brazil 70, like all that generation before them. He changed our perception. Suddenly it wasn't Brazil, Brazil, Brazil. It was Maradona. It wasn't Argentina. It was Maradona. It was one player. He literally rewrote the rules. He rewrote our expectations in the space of 4 weeks.
Yeah. And Brendan, on that point you make that you only saw some of these great players every 4 years. Can you remember, for instance, post 86, he wins the title with Napoli for the first time in 87. Would you have seen much of that Serie A season?
Not really. To be honest, I can't remember for sure exactly when Football Italia would have came on Channel 4. I would have watched it, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head now if I was glued to that. Like, I was actually thinking when you were talking about Napoli earlier, like, can we name between us three players in that Napoli team apart from Maradona? I know Correa, the Brazilian striker, was on it, but apart from that. Exactly. Like, I mean, I don't remember the team at all. And people talk about, you know, Argentina being a one-man team in 86. Who were Napoli? I mean, I'm sure they're great players, and people who know far more about football than me will be able to list off a load of them. But for guys like us who would be interested in football, the fact we don't know anybody beyond Correa and that team, that just explains again how monumental an achievement it was for what he did there.
Yeah, insane. So to move on, staying with football for a moment, just page 11, Sunday Times, it's Niall Quinn here. And he's one of many, I think, now of a certain age, very concerned over the threat of dementia. Quinn concerned over threats of bygone era, former Ireland striker wary of potential for dementia after a career spent heading the ball. Paul Roan here, 180 international caps, 40 goals shared out roughly equally between them. It was always very difficult to split Tony Cascarino and Niall Quinn when it came to deciding which of these giant strikers was better to lead the Irish line. And Cascarino started this month with an admission he was likely to develop dementia because there was a history of it in his family and he headed the ball consistently. And Quinn makes such an honest point here. And it's, you know, look, we're all about self-preservation when things get hairy. He says he did think to himself when he saw Cascarino talking earlier this month, Tony was a power header. He would head it as hard as anybody could kick it. I would loop them into the top corner. When I heard what Tony had to say, I was thinking selfishly, I wonder if that will help me if he gets it. It is terrible what goes through your head. Nobody headed the ball more than me. After training, I stayed and sometimes came in early, but I'm going to keep an eye on the research. And he remembers after training at Arsenal, the centre halves would line up and all of us would boom 60-yard balls and they would have to come and head the ball as far as they could. I was thinking, I'm glad I don't have to do that every day. I mean, it's just a frightening thought for any player who headed the ball a lot in training or otherwise. And like, there's no easy answer, you know. Quinn himself says that a neurologist told him that it's not the weight of the ball that matters so much as the relentless heading of them. And he says, Tony's a gambler and always worked out percentages. He's doing the same with this issue. I'm not in that deep. I'm just keeping myself right and hoping things are well and waiting for more evidence. I mean, for any professional footballer of that era, not least a Quinn or a Cascarino or that Arsenal back four by the sounds of things, depending on your personality, you could get very into the weeds of this thing and get very concerned, Shane.
Yeah, and I suppose the key phrase that he's used there is keeping an eye on the research. I think there's going to have to be something very, 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 very concrete for there to be any real changes, for it to be outlawed in any way. I would go as far as to say I doubt very much if the rules around heading would be changed over the next 20, 30 years. But it does take me back, Joe. I went off to Australia for a year in 2003. And while I was out there, one of the jobs I was doing was coaching in soccer camps. I was only a young fellow myself at the time. But I remember being out there, two parents, when they were dropping their kids off to me, and when I say kids, maybe 8, 9 years of age, dropping the kids in for the summer camp and pulling me to one side to let me know that their kids were not to take part in any of the heading activities that we might have penciled in for the week, and were telling me that the reason they didn't want them taking part was that they had seen research that it could lead to dementia and all of this kind of thing. And you can imagine, like, I nodded and I smiled, but as they walked away, my thought was, what sort of weirdos are they, or what sort of mollycoddled world are they attempting to bring their children up in? And, you know, you're starting to see the scare stories from the likes of Tony Cascarino now that maybe those parents were a step ahead of me, you know.
Yeah, because the piece even references, you know, when Quinn was deputy chief executive, the association chose not to follow the Scottish FA's lead on banning under 12s from heading in training. I mean, what we know about this issue in various sports is it's not the one-off incident, it's the relentless nature, it's the constant bump, bump, bump impact over and over again that does the damage over time. So, I mean, I won't be surprised if banning it in training becomes a real focal point for discussion very, very soon. Whatever about matches, which would, you know, you're talking then about transforming the game, but how much you're doing in training, a la, you know, the amount of contact training in NFL for a kind of not perfect comparison. That could come in very, very soon. And you know, when it comes to people's kids, there will be a safety first approach, you suspect. I mean, adults, there is informed consent once the information is good. But I don't know, Brendan, I even remember. And I stress for anyone listening, I'm not a doctor and I have no research done on this beyond trying to read it as much as I can in the media, but no proper scientific research read. But even like anecdotally, I remember, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, playing in central midfield, you know, by hook or by crook, the keepers were able to kick the ball about that distance. And just time and time again, you're looking up at this ball coming straight down on top of you. And like, you know, 11-year-old, I'm not sure I was the greatest header in the ball. So you're like, you're closing your eyes and it's hitting you on the top of the head and the world spins for a few seconds. Even as an 11-year-old, instinctively, you're probably thinking to yourself, well, this isn't great.
Yeah, it sounds like my experience is heading the ball. That's why I was left back for so long. Stick them as far away from anywhere that can be done damage that wise. But you look at it as well, one of the arguments about not banning training for youngsters is they have to learn the technique of it.
Sure.
And you say it as well. I mean, you close your eyes and you hope for the best. It's a wet, windy day somewhere out in the backfield somewhere, and this ball is coming down on you. And you just don't have the skills, you don't have the confidence to do it. Mm. But you take away any heading practice for somebody until the age of 15 or 18 or whatever, then you're asking them to start doing it. Is it too late at that stage?
Well, funny, sorry to interrupt, my experience of heading practice and training was the coach would stand 10 yards away and throw you the ball underarm and you'd head it back to him. You know, get your forward on it, all that kind of stuff. That didn't actually prepare you for a kick out coming down on top of you. But I mean, I wonder in those drills up to the age of 14, 15 or whatever the science says, and you know, I will bow to science at every juncture here, who's to say we have to use leather footballs? Why couldn't just use softer footballs to practice the technique of heading on the forehead?
Go
ahead, Brendan.
Sorry, no, just one thing that kind of struck me reading the Niall Quinn piece as well is here we are talking about what do we do now. I mean, what are the issues that are happening now which will lead to issues down the line? Because if you look at the Niall Quinn, Tony Cascarino thing, a lot of what we've heard about in dimension football is the England team in 66. That's like grainy black and white footage of a time long ago of hobnailed boots nearly and billowing shorts and medicine balls. So we could see that, okay, that happened in the 60s and the 70s, and now we're seeing the impact of it now. So, you know, an article like this brings it forward 20 years all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You know, I was playing football in the 80s and 90s, not to any level or in terms of quantity like these guys. But you said it as well, Joe, we're all heading footballs in this way. It brings it that much closer to our door. And here we are talking about kids now and what impact that will have going forward. So this issue has gone from, you know, sepia tinted photographs right through to our current day. And the fact of the matter is, in concussion across all levels, we still don't know how to handle it properly.
When I was up at Galway United, Joe, there was a former player for them up there called Mark Herrick, who had started to develop a piece of kit where the ball is actually suspended from a rope. Headright, I think, was the name of it, or the name of the company or something. But that's really starting to take off. I think he's got that bit of kit into most of the academies around the country at the moment. And maybe that's, you know, can we try and teach them the technique in that manner rather than throwing the ball at them? That might certainly be a step in the right direction, certainly for underage players.
Yes, okay. Well, it's not going away, I suspect. So a few last quick pieces just to give mention to. Ireland play the rugby today. Lots of people will be listening to this podcast on a Monday or Tuesday. I know they do. So we're not going to spend any time previewing the Georgia match. But just to give you a flavour of the atmosphere, for instance, Neil Francis back page. Like, it's too early to say if he's wrong or right here, is the point. But certainly he's looking at Andy Farrell and he's just not sure that, given his rugby league background, he should be a head coach. Like, for instance, he compares him to Sean Edwards. Maybe Edwards knows the limit of his abilities. Ambition is to be applauded, but maybe Edwards has a simple attitude in life. Stick to what you know and what you're good at. I'm not sure if Edwards has had any offers to be a head coach, but the pragmatist in him might just squeeze the brakes a little. He's been involved in union for over 20 years. Maybe he's smart enough not to go that extra stage to the top job because his breadth of knowledge just wouldn't match the likes of those Kiwis. Farrell knows his game, but it's not even close to having the same base knowledge of the game as Schmidt. The headmaster was a savant, the Fionn Mac Cúil of rugby. Farrell and Schmidt worked as a team with clearly defined roles. And like he does say, Farrell was brilliant as a defensive coach and talks about what a phenomenal rugby league player he was. It's hard to think of any British player who could match him for his all-round excellence. There wasn't much more for him to achieve before he turned his hand to union at the age of 31. I can only think off the top of my head of two league converts who really successfully made the jump, Jason Robinson and Chris Ashton. Neither Farrell nor Sam Burgess had their pace or finishing ability, so they struggled. He talks, like he outlines the differences with league and union. In rugby league, there are no lineouts, there are no rucks, no mauls. The scrums are a pound shop joke. The kickoffs are completely different. He says, it may be churlish or unreasonable to suggest that just because you played league, you may not be able to coach union. After all, Jose Mourinho was a humble interpreter before he won all these trophies. But he goes on to say that ultimately, Farrell's knowledge of the basics and the nuances of the game of union are not good. Now, he doesn't really elaborate on that point, but that's his opinion. And he says, the second and more obvious thing is that he's not a head coach yet. And he concludes by saying, as a superior athlete, I would be surprised if he didn't adapt and learn as he goes. If you could not learn from the headmaster, well, that's worrying. He says, getting the team to try harder and eking out more commitment from the players is not the answer. He says, Farrell may yet adapt and could also transition to become a head coach. The question is when and what cost. So to sum up Francis' point, he doesn't think Farrell, with the league background, has enough of a base to be a top head coach. He does concede he's done a really good job in lots of ways and that he may well learn on the job and improve very quickly. The question is when and what cost. I don't know. I mean, none of us can know this for sure, Shane. It would jump out at me. Even Neil Francis can't have a full appreciation of what Farrell does and doesn't know about the game.
Yeah, I suppose the first point to make is I liked his line of union is chess, whereas league is drafts. Mm. It's a very good way of him trying to paint his picture. But look, my rugby knowledge wouldn't be fantastic, Joe, but the bit that jumped out at me on it is the whole concept of going from being a number two to a number one and the massively, massively different skill set involved in both roles. And to be fair to him, I think towards the end, he kind of almost makes the point that in most modern sports, Joe, I think most people will say at the moment, the number two has the role of the number two has risen to such prominence in recent years that it's almost as important. It will never be more important than who the number one is, but it's almost now of the same level as to who the number one is. It's a huge role across any sport. And he kind of makes the point that is the problem almost as much that Cat is not as good a number two as Farrell was a number two.
Well, that's,
Farrell's not as good a number one as Schmidt.
Well, whatever way you want to do that, who's the number two or who's got the loudest voice, because all of that comes down to personalities as much as job titles. But one thing which you really can't quibble with, it's a fair point. He says, there are many questions being asked about the current coaching ticket. So he's just talking, you know, overall. He says, outwardly, it seems a little underpowered. The key difference is Schmidt out and Mike Catt in. Now, that's nothing against Mike Catt, but like, that's just a downgrade because Schmidt was so special.
Absolutely, 100%. And he, you know, again, from my side of things, looking at it, it's really interesting the way he compares it to Taylor and Clough, and how they were sensational together. Yet neither of them were were any good without the other. And I know I had said to you before we came on air that I found that this article tied in well with the one in relation to Donny Buckley leaving Kerry and Peter Keane been under pressure. Again, it's that whole idea of everybody knowing the role, everybody having a skill set that is perfectly designed to their role, and then I suppose of equal importance is that the number two, be it a Donny Buckley or initially an Andy Farrell, now Mike Catt, that ego doesn't become a problem and get in the way. But yeah, look, there's no doubt that a Farrell Mike Catt is absolutely not on the same planet as a Schmidt Farrell combination.
No, very few are on that level, you know. So Brendan, what's your take on this? Because I mean, look, Neil Francis, I suspect, is seeing things in a game of rugby that we're all not spotting, and yet at the same time, it seems, you know, a touch premature to say for sure that his knowledge of the basics isn't good, or, you know, well, I mean, the head coach point, he is definitely learning the head coaching role on the job. It's his first effort at this, so you know, it's very hard to argue. Your take on the whole thing?
Yeah, it's interesting. This was always going to be the Sunday when the rugby cars kind of got their teeth into how is this going. The Autumn Nations Cup is a free hit, as Peter O'Reilly says again in the Sunday Times today. The big game was always going to be England last week, and that was always going to be the game that they were judged on. So what we're seeing in the papers today is, as you say at the top of this one, Georgia is Georgia. We overlooked that. Yeah. This is all about looking back at England. Did they do better than they had done in the three previous games? Is there signs of progress? And there's interlinking ideas throughout all the articles that are touching on this today. Brendan Fanning's piece in the Sunday Indo talks about this what's the word he uses? He says he has hamstrung himself by not having enough experience in his coaching management setup. Obviously, that reflects on what Neil Francis said. Brendan makes the point that Farrell is an interesting character that has worked under some fantastic names, not just Joe Schmidt, Brian Ashton, Warren Eddie Gatland, Jones. Even Eddie Jones and Saracens. So I agree with you, Joe. It's far too early to say, you know, is this as good as it gets or does it move on? There's another point to this as well. David Walsh makes a very interesting counter-argument to, I suppose, the prevailing winds in his piece, in his column in the back of the Sunday Times sports section. And he says people are talking about England dominating Ireland, an 18-7 game. He talks about the highlights in Channel 4 where a commentator said something about England were well on top, and yet every clip that Channel 4 used from the second half showed Ireland in the England half of the field.
Yeah.
So it's a very clever way of saying, look, is this really the case? Shane McGrath does a piece on it as well in the Sunday Daily Mail, in the Sunday Mail as well. And both Shane and David Walsh make a point that I've been thinking a lot about in the last couple of weeks. Shane actually says it very succinctly. I don't have it in front of me. Hold on. He says, he talks about Ireland in 2018 and just one line, this was an experienced team at their peak.
Yeah.
And that has to be remembered. You look at the team that Andy Farrell has now. If it was Joe Schmidt coming in there for his first bite at an Irish team, there would be transition happening. David Walsh says, yet to be critical of the Irish failings is to ignore context. This is a team without their talismanic fly half, Johnny Sexton, the British and Irish Lions tight head, Tadhg Furlong, and their two best attacking players, Ringrose and Larmour. And the point I would make on it is, if you look at any of the successful Irish rugby teams going back to Eddie O'Sullivan's time, they had world-class players playing at the top of their game, and we just don't have that at the moment.
No, that's true. I was just going to say, well, it ties in with Brendan Fanning's piece. Freedom is overrated is the headline. So he's saying, like, the Irish players may have craved a less claustrophobic atmosphere, but without it, they look rudderless. And this is the interesting dynamic post-Schmidt. You know, 2019 was all about, like, oh, my God, we just need a bit of, let's relax a little bit. It's getting a bit intense. And the word seems to be things did ratchet up on that level in 2019. You know, you hear bits from different players and things had got a little bit over the top. But, like, let's not abandon a degree of adherence to the basics and, you know, military style preparation either, because it has got a bit loose. Like, we're seeing so many basic mistakes that you just didn't see under the majority of Schmidt's reign. Interestingly, Brendan Fanning's of the opinion that Farrell themselves on a journey with this Ireland squad. For us, the first pit stop is next March, the end of the Six Nations. At that point, there will be 14 tests at various points along the road behind him. If they looked like roadkill, then he would need a very good story to keep his job. And I was thinking, my God, are we really at that point? Is it that bad? So I don't know. It's really interesting to see if he can turn this thing around. I mean, I agree with you on the players aren't as good, but you always felt Schmidt got a tune out of even lesser players because they knew their roles so well and had the basics so down. By the way, there was just one small thing, and even Shane, if you didn't spot this, the coach and you might be interested. Just Brendan Franning outlines what the English do at halftime, and it's so regimented, so clever, really good, because you can imagine after any first half, everyone's heads are fried and there's a lot going on. So he said, England's halftime routine is as follows. And we see this on the pitch. The players have a quick yak together before they leave the field. And we always see those shots when the TV is going to ads and the English players are on the pitch having a chat. So the English players have a chat on the field. That way they go into the changing room already with an agenda. Jones gets the statistics from the analysis folks. He steps into the shower along with the senior players. They compare notes. So what were you guys talking about on the pitch? What have we seen in the stats? If they match up, then it's a short conversation. However, if Jones wants to overrule something, then that's what he does. He's still in charge. And they all get together for the last couple of minutes before going back out. I mean, it's great. It's really, really good to get an insight, Shane. That's what you guys need to start doing now, Dundalk.
Listen, it's exactly what you want. I know when Cheddar Plunkett was over the Laois Hurlers, kind of when he'd finished up at the end of the year and that, I got bits and bobs of information, and one of the things I got was, yeah, their agenda for half time, and it was incredible, Joe. It was absolutely to the minute. Like, this happens at, you know, 3:30, this happens at 3:33, this happens at 3:36, and right. Again, similar to that, the whole idea of the backs broke in one direction and spoke to one coach, forwards broke in another direction, spoke to another coach, then they both get feedback for exactly 2 minutes, and that's the way it's gone. That's the way it's gone. Absolutely military precision. No, we don't quite have it nailed down like that in the dock at the moment.
So what are you just flipping tables and saying, come on to hell, lads, and giving someone a kick? Get out there.
That's it. Yeah, simple as that.
We're pretty much out of time. The Dubs are a big focus, so we won't be able to get into this in too much depth. I suspect people are saying, oh my God, the Dubs. I don't want to hear any more about the Dubs. The Business Post, it is actually a really good piece, I have to say. Pages 2 and 3, it's in the Post Plus section. It takes the John Conlon letter, which everybody I think has read at this stage, the Westmeath player, as its jump off point. Like Bertie Ahern talks at length in it about, you know, linking up with John Bailey, the then Dublin County Board Chairman, and they came up with this idea of the coaching pilot program to be funded by the state. Pilot would send paid coaches out into all the clubs and it'd be cost millions of taxpayers' money. As Ahern says, John Bailey put the plan up and I, as finance minister, said we'll do this for 3 years, and we did, and I think we rolled it out over a few times afterwards. So it captures how the state got involved. It captures, you know, Nicky Brennan, then Leinster chairman, president of the Leinster Council, rather, you know, recognising that a lot of the clubs in Dublin were struggling and the GAA got involved. And look, we know this figure of the last 10 years, they've got, you know, 16 million, and it seems to be just way beyond per registered player, €270 per registered player in Dublin, whereas the next best county is Fermanagh, where they're getting €68, Dublin player €270 in terms of funding. And it definitely feels, Brendan, that we've reached a pinch point with this. But to be honest, we've been having this conversation for at least 4 or 5 years now, especially in Leinster. How it's going to change, I don't really know. The Dubs always come back and say, look, we practice, it's not money, it's nothing to do with money, which does beg the question, what has €16 million been spent on?
I don't know.
Even this talk of, oh, let's have a knockout championship, which no one has taken that seriously, I don't think. Like, none of that fixes the fundamental problem here. To round up my point, sorry, and it's in this piece, and Michael Clifford touches on it as well. There really is nothing to say we couldn't go the way of the Scottish Premier League, i.e. Dublin, maybe one other big team, and then a bunch of others. But like, there's nothing to say GAA football won't go that way, that it's just, you know, Dublin basically win the vast, vast majority of titles for obvious reasons, in the same way that there is dominance in other leagues like the Scottish League.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is now, I mean, it doesn't feel to me like it's come to a tipping point. Like you say, Joe, this conversation's been ongoing for so long at this stage, and it, you know, we've seen with COVID how previously intractable problems at the GAA have just been a general consensus. Oh, maybe we will split club and county, and that's the way to do it. That hasn't happened with the Dublin context. And the problem now is the GAA, like every organisation in the country and worldwide, has lost so much money that further limits what it is they can do. So what do you need for even John Conlon in that brilliant, very well penned letter that he put up last week? Even John Conlon is saying, we don't want Dublin stripped of what they have. We want the others brought up to a Dublin level. Yeah. Where does that money come from? It just doesn't. It doesn't come from anywhere. And some of the solutions that people are talking about, a kind of an NFL system where everybody goes into one commercial pot, one central funds pot. There's no, I don't see any political will or understanding that this is something that needs to do. So, like you say, we could all be sitting down having a Sunday paper review in 4 years' time. I don't see it being any different because I don't see that tipping point. But the thing about tipping points is, as we've seen this year, they just arrive out of the blue. So who knows? Maybe next week it'll all change, but I don't see it.
On your point about a Sunday paper review in 4 years' time, my producer Neil Tracy just said in my ear, please God, no. And I would like to echo those comments sincerely. Somebody has texted in as well, on Brennan's NFL draft idea, what about every year each county gets to pick one Dublin player? I mean, there's all sorts of great solutions here.
We can
come up with. I mean, the point was made, I think it was in more in Michael Clifford's piece, the point was made that the funding going towards Dublin has started to come down. So it is tightening. Shane, broad thoughts on all this? There's no easy solution. I mean, between population and the ability to harness the commercial revenue. Dublin should be, like, in a country with this, with the county makeup and the demographics the way they are, really, Dublin should win the football championship 90% of the time, shouldn't they?
Yeah, and it's going to take a hell of a lot of time to try and make any sort of reasonable attempt to redress the balance. I think, as Brendan has said, the unfortunate coincidence is that the government and the GAA seem to have realised, okay, we need to cut the funding to Dublin at exactly the time that there's pretty much no funding to go to anybody else, unfortunately. And as much as Bertie O'Hearn, who is one of the architects of their dominance, tries to claim at the end that it's been a happy coincidence of talent and that they're going to struggle to replace some of the senior players over the coming years, I don't buy that for a minute, unfortunately.
It's not looking like it thus far. Fellas, we're out of time. Thanks so much for that great stuff. Shane Keegan of the Dundalk coaching staff. We'll let you go back to, you know, mingling with Mikel Arteta and doing whatever you're doing these days. Thanks for joining us, lowly types here. And Brendan O'Brien.
This evening, Joe. Slightly different experience.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Brendan O'Brien from the Irish Examiner. Thanks, fellas.
Cheers, guys.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.